Well, before we open in prayer, I think there are some people here that maybe it's your first time. Perhaps you just took a look at the topic or heard the topic via whatever. And so we're glad to have you here. But we meet every month on a monthly basis here at the church and just cover different topics of interest as they relate to counseling. There's a brochure that you could have gotten when you came in for the BCI conference. Joe Proper used to do the counseling training here, and his annual conference. It's nice because it's local. It's just over in Garrettsville. So if you're looking for just even more ongoing help and how to care for others, I would commend that to you. The other big thing is the Marriage Matters conference or workshop. Hopefully all of you received the invitation from Jackie to the dinner. I would just really encourage you to participate in that. The dinner is free. There will be an opportunity to help make a donation, but I'm telling you, it's great. It'll just be a nice opportunity for you to have one-on-one time with a guy whose heart is for marriage counseling, who for 20 years at Westminster at CCF has done marriage counseling, is in the trenches. That's his sweet spot, as it were, is step families, blended families, divorce, remarriage. Different things like that. So he's going to be sharing. If you looked in the Dropbox, so the latest issue of the Journal of Biblical Counseling, he wrote an article in there on when not to do marriage counseling. He has seven really helpful just diagnostics of this would be different dynamics when marriage counseling together would not be helpful. So that's the 27th, 6:30. It'll be in the fellowship hall. And then the 28th is the all-day workshop. It's filling up fast. There's still scholarships available. I'll tell you one thing that I think is helpful is just, you know, maybe drop it in the mail to somebody and just say, hey, you know, don't let money keep you. Let's sit together. Let's go to this together. I think presence is always a helpful motivation sometimes for people. They feel like they have to do it alone. Childcare is provided the whole day. There's a whole program. So even if you just want to get rid of your kids for a whole day, come to this. My kids didn't want to leave the childcare program last year. They, like, loved it. So that's that. What else do I need to talk about? I do have some books that we'll give away at the end, and we'll just do some little bit of trivia for that. May. We will not meet in May for ISI because we're meeting now in April, and then you guys are coming to the Marriage Matters workshop, hopefully, at the end. So we'll take a break in May, and we'll resume in June. And so the topic today of bipolar, we'll definitely not plumb the depths. This is specifically, too, about bipolar. There's so many other directions we could go in terms of talking about depression, depressive disorders, but today we're going to at least scratch the bare surface of what depression or what bipolar is. So before we do that, let me pray for us, and we'll get started. Father, we come to you this morning, and we thank you for your good and for your many blessings. We thank you that you give us your word, which is so helpful, so insightful, Father, that portrays life as it truly is. Father, we thank you that you don't leave us in the darkness. Father, that with all the different anomalies and peculiarities that are associated with just complex psychiatric disorders like this, that at the end of the day, your Bible, it's not simplistic, but it's simple in how it describes man and his deepest needs. And so, Father, I pray that you would give every person in here hope, that we wouldn't feel unprepared or ill-equipped, but that with the knowledge of your Son, with the knowledge of your Word, with the help of your Spirit, Lord, that we would be just faithful caregivers, that we would pursue others the way that you pursued us. And we ask all this in your name. Amen. So you should have three handouts. I'll refer to all three of them at different times. You should have the basic handout. Then you should have some charts that we're going to go through together. And then you also should have that mood tracking chart, which is just a diagnostic that we'll talk about later. Let me ask you this. Let's just open it up, because what we'll do is we'll just scratch the surface in terms of trying to understand this, and then we'll take a little bit of a break, and then we'll dive into just caring. What does that look like? What would you guys, what do you know about bipolar? When I say bipolar, what comes to mind? What do you know of it, know about it, perhaps know somebody personally that's been given that diagnosis? What do we know about? Jerry? Okay.
They took her to the hospital and diagnosed her. They actually diagnosed her bipolar schizophrenic.
Okay.
She was not hallucinating, and they changed their diagnosis
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Miles.
I've noticed that it's a very sporadic come and go thing.
Okay.
People I've known have a stepson and a coworker, and once they sort of gain your trust, they have a tendency to share.
Okay.
Their ups and downs, and as she had said, they're extreme.
Okay. Okay. What else? Kim?
My ex-mother-in-law. She's passed now.
Could you speak up, please?
Speak up.
My ex-mother-in-law.
Ex-mother-in-law.
And my ex-husband
have struggled.
And there's extreme highs.
Extreme highs.
And extreme lows where they totally clamp up. And it's like you can see it in their eyes, their personality changes.
Okay. So that seems to be, so is that the main thing that you guys would know about bipolar, is that there's extreme highs and there's extreme lows? Is that the same? Okay. All right. John? Did you, or Anne?
I was going to say, I've had a friend for almost 30 years who is bipolar, and in her case, she often, particularly when she has the extreme highs, she has no memory afterwards.
Okay.
Changed so much that her way of dressing changed, mm-hmm. the way she talked changed.
Yeah.
It was a noticeable difference in her than when she's not manic.
Well, listen, one of the reasons why we want to cover this is, I mean, many of us know just the sincere, the deep tragedy of Rick and Kay Warren. Their son Matthew committed suicide about 2 weeks ago, and it came out that he had been diagnosed as bipolar. And so over the past 2 weeks, if you've been reading or keeping in touch at all with the news or what have you, it has just sprung back to the forefront in terms of the mental illness. How does the church deal with mental illness? What do we do with bipolar? How do we care for people who are that? There's all kinds of different extremes that have gone all over the place. Is the Bible relevant? People who are in the church have their heads in the sand. Mental illness, it's a medical issue. Holy, there's other people who say, no, it's wholly spiritual. You just need to read the Bible, become more calm. It's all over the place. And so today, we're going to talk about some really serious things, and it's not meant to be comical at all, because it really is, I think, one of the more discouraging, complex, and just peculiar issues out there for us as counselors to grapple with. And one of the, I think, the struggles for you all will be, is the Bible relevant to talk to this issue, right? I mean, bipolar and depression is not in the Bible, those words. You know, mania is not in the Bible. So there's already an immediate hill that we have to climb in terms of, well, is the Bible, does the Bible speak into this issue at all? And if it does, how does it? Is it merely descriptive? Is it prescriptive? Is it theological in nature? I thought I would just read a couple of different excerpts from two different things. There was an article that has come out about DSM-5. DSM-5 is the Diagnostic and Statistic Manual for Psychologists and Psychiatrists. And it's in its fifth revision, so DSM-5, and it's, you know, it's called the Bible. It's called the Bible for Psychologists. But DSM, Diagnostic and Statistic Manual, DSM, is typically how it's referred to. It's a massive, massive book. But this was on Slate.com. It said that probably by the time it comes out this summer, that with the DSM-5 categories, the odds will probably be that 50% of the American population will be able to be diagnosed with a mental disorder, with a mental illness. How does that happen, that over half of us develop a mental illness? They list multiple different reasons, talking about we've gotten better at detecting mental illness earlier on, that we're getting sicker as time has gone on. Rosenberg writes, and I'm not saying this to be funny. It's really heartbreaking. Rosenberg goes on. He says the more recently an American is born, the more likely he or she is to develop a psychological disorder. Collectively, this line of research indicates that more is going on than simply better detection of mental illness. So he's saying, listen, not only are we detecting it earlier, but more and more people are legitimately having it. She writes, what was once considered psychologically healthy is now considered to be illness. The increasing prevalence and overall number of disorders has skyrocketed. In DSM-1, which came out in 1952, there was 106 listed psychological disorders. In DSM-3, it went up to 265. In DSM-4, it has gone up to 297. DSM-5 is not going to increase the amount of disorders, but what DSM-5 will do is that we'll add more subcategories to the already existing diagnosis. For instance, Asperger's used to be, people said we need a separate category, and so now Asperger's will come underneath high-functioning autism or underneath the autism spectrum. So ongoing, the disorders in DSM-5, they can be wholly medical in nature. He goes on to say, for instance, people who are extremely shy and concerned about how others might evaluate them and who avoid certain types of activities can now be diagnosed with avoidant personality disorder. These same characteristics didn't used to be considered pathological, and in some other cultures, they're not considered to be so. Here's a major change, right? DSM-5 will change in the criteria for general anxiety disorder, generalized anxiety disorder, panic attacks, things like that, a very, very common diagnosis. It's a disorder that involves excessive and persistent worrying. In the criterion for DSM-4, you needed to have 3 out of the 6 symptoms for this diagnosis. So here are the 6 symptoms in DSM-4 to be diagnosed with generalized anxiety disorder: restlessness, easy fatigue, difficulty concentrating, irritability, muscle tension, sleep disturbance. Okay? Those are all just, that's, right, right. Those are all different things, yeah. So who has it? So according to DSM-4, you needed to have 3 of the 6 in a setting that was at least habitual and ongoing cyclical for 6 months. Now in DSM-5, to qualify for that diagnosis, you only need to have 1. You only need to have 1 of the 6. Rosenberg goes on to say, though, that an unfortunate thing is that one study has found that 70% of the DSM-5 task force members, so 70%, it's an international board that writes DSM-5, have financial ties to the pharmaceutical industry. As we continue to go on, here's the last line that I thought, listen, this is where the church really needs to step up. Instead of demagoguing mental illness or not trying to understand it or have our heads in the sand, listen to what Rosenberg writes. She says, as our lives take on an even more frantic pace and our workload becomes even greater, having a diagnosis, it gives a name to the suffering we feel, and it gives us hope that with a label can come relief. In dark or difficult times, hope is essential. But I'm not sure that ultimately labeling half of the American population with a mental disorder is the best way to give people realistic hope. Right? I mean, I thought, gosh, man, Rosenberg, she's so close. She's there. She realizes, listen, as we think through who man is and all the different maladies that accompany him, to give a person a diagnosis, to expand out, listen, this is what you are and this is descriptive of you, at the end of the day, that only does so much to relieve suffering. That only does so much to give hope. And so the church really does, I think, need to come to the forefront and be able to address these issues and address them, I think, in a compassionate, holistic way. If the first line of conversation is bipolar is a made-up issue, there's no such thing as mental illness, you're just not going to get anywhere in the conversation. So I want all of us to be able to take away from this dialogue and from this discussion, how can you, in a Christ-like way, interact with these issues? How can you thoughtfully and biblically care? One of the things I think you guys know I love to read, and Kay Redfield Jamison has written, I think, Cheryl, I recommended this book for one of your people, An Unquiet Mind, which I list in their resources. Kay Redfield Jamison is an internationally known researcher on bipolar. She is bipolar. She's a visiting professor at UCLA and at Johns Hopkins. But she wrote a memoir called An Unquiet Mind, which is basically her autobiography of struggle with bipolar. And so I want to read some excerpts for you, because I think what it'll do is it'll help give you an idea. Because one of the struggles with bipolar is that it's so, for us maybe who have not encountered this issue personally, meaning we haven't had this, It's difficult for us to understand. Jameson will actually make the claim later in the book. She'll say it's impossible. Anybody who has not had it really can't understand it. But at least she can give us an insight into it. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, she's not a believer, so don't, I mean, if you're thinking, man, she's going to give me this wonderful Christ-centered hope of how she overcame bipolar, that's not what you're reading for, but what you're reading for is somebody who has gone through it. Here, she's describing a mania period here. She says, there's a particular kind of pain, of elation, of loneliness, and terror involved in my madness. When you're high, it's tremendous. The ideas and the feelings are fast and frequent. They're like shooting stars, and you follow them until you find better and brighter ones. Shyness goes away, the right words and gestures, they're suddenly there. The power to captivate others is a felt certainty. There are interests found in uninteresting people. Sensuality is pervasive. The desire to seduce and to be seduced is irresistible. Feelings of ease, of intensity, of power, of well-being, of financial omnipotence and euphoria pervade one's body. But somewhere this changes. The fast ideas become far too fast. There are far too many. Overwhelming confusion replaces clarity. Memory goes. Humor and absorption in friends' faces are replaced by fear and concern. Everything previously moving with the grain is now against you. You're irritable. You're angry. You're frightened. You're uncontrollable. You're enmeshed totally in the blackest caves of the mind. You never knew those caves were there. It will never end, for madness carves its own reality. Which of my feelings are real? Which of the me is me? Is it the wild, the impulsive, the chaotic, the energetic, the crazy one? Or is it the shy, the withdrawn, the desperate, the suicidal, the doomed, the tired one? It's probably a bit of both, hopefully much that is neither. Virginia Woolf in her Dives and Climbs said it all. How far do our feelings take their color from the dive underground? I mean, what is the reality of any feeling? What's the reality of any feeling? I'll read another incident. She says, talking about one of the instances that comes with the mania is just this desire. You feel like you can do anything, and in a financial way, that becomes problematic. People spend enormous amounts of money. She says, when I'm high, I couldn't worry about money even if I tried. She says, so I don't. The money, it'll come from somewhere. I'm entitled to money. God will provide it for me. Credit cards, they're disastrous. Personal checks, they're worse. Unfortunately, for manics anyway, mania is a natural extension of the economy. What with credit cards and bank accounts there's little beyond reach. So I bought 12 snakebite kits with a sense of urgency and importance. I bought precious stones, elegant and unnecessary furniture. One day I bought 3 Rolex watches and totally inappropriate siren-like clothing. During one spree in London, I spent £200 on books having titles that somehow just caught my fancy. Books on the natural history of a mole. 20 books on penguins and how they form colonies. Once I think I even shoplifted a blouse because I couldn't wait a minute longer for the woman with molasses feet in front of me in line, so I stuck it in my purse and I left. Or maybe I just thought about shoplifting. I don't remember. I was totally confused. I imagine I must have spent far more than $30,000 during my one manic episode, and God only knows how much more during my frequent wilder manias. So this helps begin to give you an insight into just, listen, this is the depth. It's so hard. It's a struggle, right? Because it seems so other than us, and so it can cause us to put distance between us. There's going to be 3 major tenets, and you don't need to write it down because we'll come to it later, but that the secular world would say these are absolutely pillars of treatment for people with bipolar. It's medication, it's therapy, counseling, and it's changing how you think, cognition. So medication, changing how you think, cognitive issues, and getting counseling. All of which she does. All of which she does. Which shows you, listen, you're actually very close to what the Bible is calling you to, right? The Bible is calling you to what? Into relationships, calling you to find someone that can truly give you hope. Here's how she describes counseling. She says, psychotherapy is a sanctuary for me. Psychotherapy is a sanctuary for me. And she goes on to say, as she describes the different things that are associated with her bipolar, she talks about relationships. The one thing that continued to pull her out of all of her manic episodes was a relationship. It would be a relationship with a man The two men in her life, both of her husbands died suddenly, one of a massive heart attack, one got killed. And so all of the different movements, you can see the seedbed is there, the ground is there for real hope. But at the end of the day, she has no category for Christ. There's no category for something outside of myself to help me. So with that, let's dive into our notes. What is bipolar? Bipolar disorder, it is also known as manic depressive illness. Manic depressive is the old name for bipolar. It was removed in, I think, 1980 from DSM-3 because people thought that manic depressive was stigmatizing. It was embarrassing. And so bipolar is the new name. You rarely will hear people. Actually, Redfield Jameson advocates. She says manic depressive is probably a better term. But you don't find many people today who advocate for that. Most people are going to refer to it as bipolar. This definition is from the National Institute of Mental Health, so I don't want you to say, what are you talking about? It's a brain disorder that causes unusual shifts in mood, energy, activity levels, and the ability to carry out day-to-day tasks. That's just the basic definition. Some basic facts. 3 to 8% of people have experienced all bipolar spectrum disorders at least once in their life. It's an equal opportunity problem across race, gender, and ethnicity. There really has not been a certain demographic, whether it be female or male. It's pretty equal opportunity in terms of who it affects. Age of onset tends to be late adolescence or early adulthood. Half of all cases begin before the age of 25, and I would say that's very true to my experience. Almost everyone that I have met that has struggled with this, it's happening sometime around 18 to 25, late adolescence. It's episodic and cyclical in nature, meaning that it's not just this one-time thing where, oh man, I have a bad day. That's not what it is. We're going to get to a little section later on what bipolar is not. Bipolar is not mood swings. So I thought it was interesting that the main definition that you guys take away from bipolar is just high highs and low lows, because that can get interpreted many different ways. Bipolar is not mood swings. It's not somebody's really happy one day and then sad the next day. That's not what bipolar is. It's episodic and it's cyclical in nature. Some estimate that at least 25% of the U.S. population will carry the label of depression, anxiety, or bipolar sometime in their lifetime. Listen, how do people describe bipolar, right? It's always with some type of verb, right? It's, I am what? I am bipolar. Put a medical disease in here. I am cancer. I am, right? You already can begin to see then what this does. What does this word do here? It builds identity. It builds identity. You and I would never say, I am cancer, or I am flu, or, you know, I am hypothyroidism. But what happens is, with the insertion of this, and then any other word here, I am depressed, I am bulimic. What it does is it says at the end of the day, listen, this word right here, this shapes and directs identity. Now listen, I understand why people say this. I do. But what we have to understand as believers is then this is one of the movements and directives of Scripture is what is identity? Who defines it and what does that look like? Four causes of bipolar. Oh, I forgot to show you guys pictures of my kids. Sorry, that's like, there's Ruby. Talking about bipolar, I'm like all over the place. So there's Ruby. She's about 2.5 months old. She sleeps and eats. That's basically what she does. So there's Riley. She just turned 2. And then Ava. That gives you a little insight into her personality, what she likes to do, loves to dress up, great imagination. So can't believe I forgot those. So four causes that the medical community would attribute. Why do I have bipolar? Number one, genetic predisposition. The word that you could put alongside with that would be nature. Just people are born with it. Redfield Jameson is convinced that bipolar is hereditary, which there's ongoing research that is being done on that, but she's gonna tie her wagon to that. It is hereditary. It's so much to the point, and Redfield Jameson says that's one reason why I never had children. I never wanted to have children because I was so fearful of passing this on. She talks about her nieces and her nephews and just sinking her life into them. So you see the depth to which this is a strong, pervasive issue for us today. Number two, neurobiological weakness. People would just, the medical community is going to say, listen, there's just disordered synapses and circuits. There's just neurobiologically, there is just stuff that's going on in your body and in your mind that leads to these types of behaviors. Number three, socio-environmental stressors. This can be anything. Light conditions, seasonal changes, lack of sleep, job loss, grief. The mania episodes for most people are triggered in, does this surprise us? Almost all mania episodes are typically triggered by some type of interpersonal conflict. One of the new and upcoming therapies for bipolar, it's called interpersonal psychotherapy. And interpersonal psychotherapy basically helps people who have bipolar, how do I deal with conflict? How do I deal with difficult relationships? Well, who speaks best to that? Who can talk about that with clarity and with hope and with love? Christians can, right? People who understand and know the body of Christ. So I just think it's so fascinating. I think that, you know, if you come in thinking, man, this is so outside me, I don't know what I can do, I think there's actually a lot of different touch points. The last one is cognition, and this is a major one for cognitive behavioral therapy. How do you think? People who struggle with bipolar, the main thing is going to be, listen, just change how you think. Change how you think. What have we consistently said in here about cognitive issues in cognitive behavioral therapy? Change is never less than cognitive, but it's always more than. It's never less than just changing how you think, changing a thought pattern, but it goes deeper than that. It goes into relationships. It's effective. It's relational. It's holistic. If I can change my entire life just really by changing how I think, well, I can do that on my own. I can train myself to think some different thoughts, but where does the renewing of the mind come in? Where does the person and work of Christ come in? Where does Ephesians 4:23 come in? Where does Romans 12:2 come in? So I like cognitive behavioral therapy, but I don't want us to settle for something less than what I think is total change that's possible through Christ. Ellen Frank, who's a famous researcher on this issue, her basic way of understanding this is she says, listen, when social stressors are more than social stabilizers, this increases lack of stability, which you can see, right? She's saying, listen, when your life gets out of balance and those stressors, those socio-environmental stressors, those neurobiological weaknesses, it's like a perfect storm. When that happens, you're going to have that imbalance. Typical warning signs. Let's first make a definition of what bipolar is. In Before we do that, we have to describe some of the definitions that are included within the definition of bipolar, which is manic episode and depressive episode. A manic episode is an overly joyful or excited, overexcited state for at least what? 3 to 4 days straight. So that's why I said this is not just, you know, you won, you know, you had a good day and, oh man, that I must be a mania. This is something that is heightened. You heard what Redfield Jameson was talking about. It is this heightened sense of emotion for a consistent period of time, 3 to 4 days straight. A depressive episode is an extremely sad or hopeless state. 5 or more of the 9 criteria, which we can discuss later, must be present for 2 weeks, to be diagnosed with a major depressive episode, okay? So before we even get to bipolar, and bipolar is going to be, listen, 1 manic episode, 1 depressive episode, this is the criterion that you need to be able to reach. Remember, there is no medical test for depression or bipolar. There's not. There's no blood test. There's no laboratory. So all diagnoses has to be based on what? Symptoms. On symptoms being matched up to predetermined criteria in the DSM-IV manual. That presents some complications, right? Okay. Let's say Becky and I are seeing the same person. What I think is maybe, oh, I think that you match up to 5 of the 9 criterion. Becky meets with them, and she might think, you only meet up with 4 of the 9 criterion. So you could have the same person meeting with the 2 different psychiatrists or psychologists coming away with 2 completely and totally different things. I was talking to my friend down in Green, and he's an LPCC, so he can sign off on diagnosis and write diagnoses without supervision. He said, listen, He goes, most of the time, I only have 40 minutes. I only have 40 minutes. And if in that first session, I don't give them a label, we don't get reimbursed. There is no medication able to be given, and then they leave here. And we already know that 50% of all cases end after the first initial meeting. So he says, I've got 40 to 45 minutes to get them something. Otherwise, my private practice time in says, listen, you're not bringing any income. What are you doing? It says, I'll just say, listen, you got minor adjustment disorder. Send them off so I can at least get them in the door. But that becomes part of the problem. Charles Hodge writes, he says, and this is documented, a national survey was done, a quarter of psychiatrists and a half of primary care doctors, because that's a major change, that primary care doctors can now write prescriptions for antidepressants, surveyed said they don't even use the criteria for DSM-4 when making a depression diagnosis. They don't even use it. They just say, listen, I'll talk with you a little bit. I'm not going to pull it out. It's listen, at the amount of caseloads and the amount of people that are struggling now, there's just not the time for thoughtful, intentional care. DSM-4 on page 349 says no laboratory findings that are diagnostic of a major depressive episode have been identified. I mean, listen, they're even aware of their own limitations. I mean, if you have cancer, what happens? You get a biopsy. It's told benign, malignant, what stage are you at? That doesn't happen with depression or bipolar. You're being diagnosed based off symptoms being interpreted by a subjective person, okay? I'm not saying any of this to demean the process, but just to help you understand when people get the diagnoses or when they're talking about it, that's what's being talked about. So when many people with the Rick Warren issue have said, listen, mental illness, it is a disease, it's biological in nature, you have to understand what they're saying. It's medical in nature from the sense of it's been medically diagnosed according to these standards. There's no blood work, there's no lab tests that say, oh, you are this. It's strictly off the criterion of the DSM-4 manual. So, Kim?
What do they say then when different people will say, oh, he has a chemical imbalance?
Right.
An old way of-
No, it's not. I mean, that's very, very popular. But the... I mean, we don't have time to get into it, but the chemical imbalance theory, it's just not widely proven. It's not widely attested to people, even within their own community, and we'll talk about it maybe a little bit later. There's not unity on that. There just isn't. So what would be some basic characteristics? Let's get out the charts, because I thought it would be helpful to give you guys these three charts to help you understand before we even get into some of these different categories. Because there is so much confusion. So on that left-hand side, these are all coming underneath the auspices. I'm looking at the mood disorder chart. There is two categories, bipolar disorders and depressive disorders. That's why we are not talking about depression today. We're talking about bipolar. There are four types that people are diagnosed with. So when you say bipolar, that doesn't even mean anything nowadays. Is it bipolar 1? Is it bipolar 2? Is it cyclothemic disorder? Is it bipolar disorder, NOS? And we're going to define all of these so you know what they mean. Bipolar NOS is not otherwise specified. It's called the trash basket, because if you don't match up to 1, 2, or 3, well, then we give you number 4, because we just really cannot quantify it. So I had a family in earlier this week, and I said, listen, the husband is bipolar. I said, what does that look like? What does that mean? He goes, I don't know. My psychiatrist did not explain it to me. Go, is it 1? Is it 2? Is it this? Is it that? And finally, we were able to find out he was the fourth category. Okay? Let's go over to the next one. This maybe helps you see it in a different way in terms of seeing these mood elations or the range of total mood variations, which could perhaps be a little bit beneficial for you. If the top end, this top line is mania, and this bottom line is depression, and this middle line is normality, which already, who sets the line of what normality is? That's a good, listen, that's a very good question. That's a very good question. Who defines this? What does normality look like? We'll get to a little bit later. There's a major work that's just come out. It's called The Loss of Sadness. And it talks about how, especially in American culture, we probably don't know how to be sad, in that the Bible speaks very clearly to mourning and to grieving and to sorrow, that this line of normality for many people probably is going to be a little bit more underneath. So bipolar 1, which is classic manic depressive, is the lowest of low and the highest of high manias. I think bipolar 1, a lot of people say I'm bipolar and they're thinking this, but that's probably not the true diagnosis. Bipolar 1, you are having consistent high manic episodes. You're having, you know, in some cases, you're having somebody run out naked in traffic because they want to do it. You have somebody talking to toasters, to oranges, to, you know, inanimate objects. You have somebody who's flying halfway across the country and spending $30,000 of credit card debt. You have somebody, you know, going out soliciting a prostitute, sleeping with them. That's the high mania that we're talking about. It's not, oh, I feel really great today, and that becomes a manic episode. Bipolar 2 is the consistent depression, but only one, the manic episode is not as high. They're going to call it a hypomanic episode. Bipolar 1 manic type, which I didn't even include, is we are consistently staying at this level, but hypermania, meaning, listen, they are below that line, a little bit more depression. Manic episode, that's clearly what a manic episode, major depressive episode. Cyclothemia probably is becoming more and more diagnosed, but cyclothemia is we're not quite there on either end in terms of depression, in terms of going all the way down to depression, and we're not all the way at the top of bipolar, of the mania, so it's cyclothemia. Dysthemia is just no mania is represented, but just a consistent below-the-line normality, okay? Hypomania, you can see what hypomania is, so hypomania helps you understand cyclothemia, because cyclothemia is an episode of a hypomanic episode. So bipolar 2 has hypomania coupled with the depression. So you see what we're doing? What is bipolar 2? It's an episode of hypomania and then deep, deep depression. And so then you see the normal, right? This is the normal line. So maybe you can't distinguish that between cyclothemia, but listen, you're kind of staying right there in that level, okay? So this is helpful for you just to basically to be able to describe what all the different disorders look like. Let's look at some of those different symptoms that are underneath there, bulleted for you, no fear of anything, even God, ignoring advice of others, seeing others as simply in the way that you want to, drug and alcohol abuse, sleep deprivation, overstimulation. That would be, the overstimulation is definitely a hallmark of high mania, is that there is this sense that you can do whatever you want without any consequences. And a lot of mania has a sexual nuance to it. There's an over-realized sense of sensuality. There is sexual sin that oftentimes accompanies it. Redfield Jameson writes this one episode where she's at a dinner party, and she goes, and she's just talking to everybody. She thinks that she's the life of the party. Everybody is loving her. And she goes in the next day to see her psychiatrist who was at this dinner party, and he goes, you were a mess. You had makeup all over your face. You were dressed wildly inappropriate. You were flirting with everybody. You were throwing yourself at many of the different men at the party. And she goes, I didn't even remember that. She goes, I just thought it was a great time and everybody was loving me. But there's this over-realized sense of one's sexuality, of who they are, how they come across to other people. So you can go on down. Those are just maybe some more descriptive ways to describe bipolar. If you turn over the page, those bipolar categories, which are defined there for you, this comes straight from National Institute of Mental Health. Bipolar 1, bipolar 2, bipolar NOS, not otherwise specified, and then cyclothemia are there for you. Remember what bipolar is not, and I'll just say it again. It's not mood swings. It's not moodiness. It's not, oh, I just can't control my anger. I just don't have self-control. That's not what bipolar is. One of the troubling things that I've found lately in counseling is that a lot of people come in self-diagnosed. They know what bipolar is. It's the number one diagnosed mental illness next to depression. And so it's just widely known. I had a couple come in, and the husband goes, listen, my wife is bipolar. She needs help. And as we started talking, yeah, I mean, it was definitely there, but you know what? Over 5 weeks in just helping her establish some routines, she was completely 100% better without medication. I mean, she was doing like 1:30 a.m. Taco Bell runs. She was falling asleep around 4 a.m., not getting up till 12. They were living and working together, so there's a huge degree of relational tension in her marriage as well as in her vocation because she lived and worked with her husband and her employer. And it was all of these different external circumstances, and the husband was absolutely, totally committed to my wife is bipolar. And over a 4 to 5 week period of time, just helping her establish just some basic routines, she was able to pull out, as it were, without medication. And she was incredibly encouraged. Secular treatment. So I had alluded to this earlier. David Miklowicz, who has written a famous book that's widely used by a lot of people who struggle with this called The Bipolar Disorder Survival Guide, he points to three. These are religious pillars for the treatment of bipolar that Redfield Jameson is going to echo. Medication, changing of the environment, and changing how one thinks. Medication is going to be the holy grail of treating bipolar. I have included for you a list of common medications. For Redfield Jameson, it is lithium. Lithium is probably the classic drug that's used to treat bipolar. And bipolar for her, lithium is a savior. She hated taking it, but she believes so strongly in it. I mean, it is, she describes this one instance where she hadn't told one of her boyfriends that she was bipolar. She was in London, and she was, you know, there, you know, in a tourist spot. She trips, and her purse falls out, and her prescription bottle of lithium falls out all over the ground, and she's so embarrassed. She's so ashamed that she's on medication because she's a psychiatrist at UCLA, and she teaches on bipolar and mental illness. And she goes, listen, she goes, I'm not going to bend down. The street's dirty. I'm not going to scoop up all these pills. But her boyfriend, who is also a psychiatrist, she has to open up to him and tell him, listen, I need you to write me a prescription while we're here on vacation for medication, for lithium, because she realized, listen, if I don't take it, I'm not going to be able to survive. So even having to cross that barrier. So medication, you're not going to read anything from a secular vantage point, I doubt, that would not have medication as a key component. And we'll talk about how to think through that later. Number two, changing the environment. Miklowicz is going to say, listen, and I want you to listen because these are all things that you and I probably would encourage too. He says, avoid all drugs and avoid all alcohol use. Deal quickly with conflicts. Stick to a wise schedule. Opt for predictability. Go to bed and rise at the same time. Avoid all-nighters. Avoid rapid and significant changes to the routines of your life. I have no problem with any of that, right? There's scriptural principles attached to all of that. The third thing, changing how one thinks, of course, that is the cognitive element that we've talked about. He's very big on, listen, think through your relationships, think through how you come across to other people. And, of course, coupled with that is you need help to do that. You need counseling. Ed Welch, I think, is helpful here. He writes some suggestions, because Welch is interacting with Miklowicz's book. He says, some suggestions seem like common sense. Some seem misguided. But here's the key. You got to underline it. All need renewal of the heart and the power of God in order to truly be successful. That's what we're talking about, you guys. That's the difference that Christ makes. That's why the gospel, it doesn't just transform, listen, oh yeah, now we go to church, but listen, this is the power for life and for godliness. This changes every aspect of who I am. And so that's why I think, listen, the church should be a safe place for people that struggle with this to come, to talk, to get help. Because all of these different things, medication, changing how I think, and changing socio-environmental stressors, all of those, they could be good, but they all require what? Renewal of the heart and the power of God. We can maybe get you to a more stable spot where your high highs and your low lows are more like this, but leave your heart completely unaffected, right? That's the big trouble. You could be perfectly normal and still be going to hell, still be separated from God, still not be in relationship with Christ. So that is just absolutely huge. Let's talk about medications. I'm not going to go over all of these for you, but Lamictal and lithium are the first line of choices for bipolar. Depakote sometimes gets offered to this. Seroquel, Zyprexa, Prozac, those SSRI drugs, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. Antidepressants can be used for bipolar depressions, but oftentimes in low doses and with close monitoring, since sometimes antidepressants can precipitate manic episodes. So it's the classic dynamic of medications causing other issues that then require medications. So you've got things like Abilify, which is a medication that helps your antidepressant. You have on alcohol, you've got people that are heavily addicted to methadone. Methadone helps people get off of alcohol, but now we're having to do methadone clinics to help people get off of methadone because they've gotten on methadone to get away from alcohol. So it's very, very cyclical in nature sometimes, but Lamictal, lithium, those are just some very basic common drugs in treating bipolar. Jay Fournier, Robert DeRuby, Steve Hold, and Steve Holland wrote a recent article in the Journal of the American Medical Association entitled Antidepressant Drug Effects and Depression Severity. Listen to what they said. They said true drug effect was non-existent to negligible for individuals with mild, moderate, and even severe depression. Only in severe depression was true drug effect seen as compared to even the placebo. And that's why I'm saying, if we go back to Kim's question of the chemical imbalance, there are significant studies that are being done now in the upstream field of psychiatry and psychology that says, you know, we do need to rethink through medication, because medication and how we're using it it's definitely not working. It's not achieving the results that we thought. Robert Whitaker, who's a New York Times columnist, wrote a great book called The Anatomy of an Epidemic. And he just says, listen, America in particular, we are at abnormal growth rates for medication. He makes comparisons to third world countries in Africa, Southeast, I mean, deeply, deeply poor and impoverished. And he says, why don't we see similar rates of depression and mental illness in third world countries as we do here in America? He says it's a total epidemic. And he ties a lot of it to the pharmaceutical industry. I'm not knocking it, but I'm just giving you their own self-critique. Jerry? A lot of it is trial and error. You know, the guy I met with said that he went through six medications over a five-month period of time until he found something. He ended up landing with Lamictal. So it is a little bit of trial and error. I think it's a little bit of hocus-pocus sometimes, you know, just depending. Right. I mean, there's a lot of struggle. You would be surprised if you Google that article, and there's a book that I've recommended to you, too, where they just do some basic work on placebo drugs, and the placebos are in some areas outpacing the medications. It's amazing. It's really amazing. Sometimes it does. I mean, Kay Redfield Jamison, she stuck with lithium for probably over 15, 20 years, and she's found it to be very, very beneficial. Some people will try to have conversations. The guy that I talked to this week, you know, had a conversation. He's about 6 years out now about reducing his medication. But we'll get later to, we're going to take a little bit of a break now, but we'll talk about how do we think through medication, because there's, you know, maybe a stereotype of we're very anti-medication, and hopefully people don't think that, or that we don't come across like that, especially here at the church. But we do need to think about medication from a biblical vantage point, and I'll try to provide some different things for that. So let's take like a 5-6 minute break. We'll come back, and we'll head into maybe more of the biblical paradigm. How do we think through this?